The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
We've now heard it confirmed. The Olympic Games will be held under a state of emergency. It's pretty extraordinary to think about the decision that Japan's Prime Minister announced earlier this morning. He said that bars, restaurants and karaoke parlors that serve alcohol must be made to close. He said it was to prevent the future spread of the virus. No areas where people can gather and to celebrate. All this is due to go into effect Monday, and it'll last through the Games to August 22nd. Now, cases in Japan do remain relatively low compared to most countries, but they are now rising exponentially.
So here's the amazing statistic. Today, 940 million people, almost a billion people worldwide, are in lockdown, which is closures of non-essential businesses. That is actually more than in January. Now, we know that the U.S. has essentially opened up, and we know that most of Europe has opened up, but there are plenty of emerging markets like India, Indonesia, South Africa, that are in worse shape today than they were at the beginning of the year. And even some of the developed economies like Japan, of course, hosting the Olympics pretty soon, Taiwan, Korea, look problematic as well.
So there are headwinds to global growth. I do think that the market is underestimating the inflation shock we're going to go through. And next week is going to be interesting. It's not going to answer all questions, but it's going to start giving us more data. And I also think that the market underestimates that the Fed has fallen behind and that there's going to be growing pressure within the Fed to accelerate that timetable.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The stock market staged an impressive rally back to new record highs after Thursday's sell-off on global growth worries and the spread of the Delta variant. Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Sheridan, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. This week's market technician is Dave Keller from StockCharts.com, who thinks we may be looking at a near-term top or cooling off in the market from current levels. Later, Frank Holmes, a U.S. Global Investors, provides an update on commodities as well as some of the big trends taking shape in the crypto space with China's crackdown. Lastly, toward the end of today's show, our CIO, Chris Poplava, joins us for another edition of Smart Macro to discuss his outlook on the larger economic and market cycle. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Let's talk about market sentiment and the change in theme throughout the week. The one consistent theme throughout the volatility was the 10-year Treasury yield. All eyes have been focused on the trend in yield for the 10-year Treasury for the past couple of weeks for an indication on growth sentiment, but more so this week as sentiment seemed to turn on a dime midday Thursday with follow-through on Friday. And I think the two professionals that understand the change in sentiment best are John Bird and John Fortune.
The financial markets, to use the common phrase, are driven by sentiment.
What does that mean?
Well, things, let's say, are just going along as normal in the market. And then, suddenly, out of the blue, one of these very sharp and sophisticated people says, "My God, something awful's going to happen! We've lost everything! Oh, my God, what are we going to do?
Shall I jump out of the window?
Exactly. Let's all jump out of the window.
Sell!
We've lost it. Sell!
Yes,
precisely.
Yes.
And then, a few days later, this same sophisticated person says, "You know, I think things are going rather well." And everybody says, I agree with you. I think we're rich.
Bye, bye, bye.
And that's what we call market sentiment.
All kidding aside, for the month of June, there has been a rotation out of value and reflationary stocks into growth and tech. This has been happening as the 10-year Treasury yield has been falling. The reasons for the drop in yield have been numerous. Concerns that the U.S. economy is at or near a peak in growth, not necessarily recession, but a peak in growth. Concerns over the COVID-19 Delta variant, which could cause a lockdown, especially overseas. And the idea that the Fed and many that inflation data is transitory and will moderate soon. The stock sectors hit the hardest have been financials, industrials, materials, and energy, basically the reflationary trade. With a drop in yields, growth has resumed leadership over value, as well as large cap over small. So the same trends we have seen over the past few weeks carried into Tuesday and Wednesday. What I saw Thursday was different. While the 10-year Treasury plummeted this week from 1.43% to 1.26% by midday Thursday, what I saw Thursday looked to be de-risking versus rotation and positioning, like we've been seeing for all of June and early in the week. The news before the open was that Japan was extending its state of emergency for Tokyo. There was a ban on spectators at the Olympics. Reports of increased cases linked to the COVID Delta variant, short coverings in the 10-year Treasury, and finally, rumors the People's Bank of China was considering a cut in its reserve ratio for banks, normally something you don't do except when things begin to weaken, all of which seemed to signal that maybe stocks needed a break after hitting record highs last week. These items all hit Asian markets before ours, where there were losses and influenced our futures. Concerns over the Delta variant of COVID weren't matching up with some of the stock performances like Peloton and Zoom, both down on the day, but could still be considered a factor for global growth decelerating and those concerns. Our analysis over credit wasn't matching up against concerns for peak growth that have been showing up in the Treasury yield. High yield, which is influenced by default risk and economic deceleration, hit a high last week, as reflected in the HYG ETF. In fact, just announced this week, on Thursday, consumer credit in May increased $35.3 billion, the largest since December of 2010. True, we've seen the ISM non-manufacturing index for June decelerate down to 60.1 from 64 in May. However, you know, reading into the analysis, it shows companies are mainly having problems with supply chains and finding qualified employees versus demand falling off. Implied gas demand hit a record recently, according to Bloomberg, and crude inventories are dropping below the five-year average, none of which suggests the economy is slowing down. We think the reopening trend continues, but I'm sure Chris Poplava will dig deeper into those areas during Smart Macro. But midday Thursday, whether due to technical levels being overdone on the 10-year Treasury or sentiment changing, everything reversed course. The Russell 2000 Small Cap Index rallied to close only down 0.9% from a decline of 2.7% intraday. Large cap stocks had recouped a lot of their losses. The 10-year only down 3 basis points, and oil was actually up on the day 1.1%. The consumer discretionary sector barely registered a loss, only down 0.1% as a result of Amazon and Tesla closing up on the day when they were down earlier. Stocks continued to follow through on the recovery efforts through Friday and closed the week at a new high for the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and the NASDAQ Composite. Interestingly, it was the reflationary stocks that took the lead here, with financials up 2.8%, energy and materials up 2%, industrials up 1.6%. Of course, the financials will be the big sector to watch next week as the earnings season kicks off on Tuesday with JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, with many more like Bank of America, BlackRock, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Charles Schwab, and PNC Financial reporting on Wednesday. So no surprise to see this group trade well on Friday ahead of those earnings and as a result of yields climbing back up. The Federal Reserve released its semiannual monetary policy report to Congress on Friday, but there were no surprises, so no catalyst there. Powell will be reporting on the results directly with the committees in Congress during the week, so another area to watch. That's it for this week's wrap-up report, but a bit of a shift in sentiment on yields midday Thursday, which had some follow-through on Friday to help stocks close at a new high.
The markets are dominated by an unseen narrative machine. FS Insider spoke with Ben Hunt, author of the widely read Epsilon Theory newsletter, to discuss his work and research regarding the narrative machine, how it differs from Ray Dalio's conception of the economic machine, and why this is one of the most powerful frameworks for understanding how the markets and global economy function. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week on FS Insider.
When reality starts to become an edge case, in physics terms, when you start going really fast or you start dealing with truly massive objects. In our cases, you know, of human worlds, social worlds, it's like global quantitative easing, central banks that dominate everything. These are edge cases. And I think that when these events happen, when reality becomes an edge case, you have to focus on the more fundamental laws of the universe, in this case, a social universe, to make sense of what's happening now and to calculate what's going to happen next. I think that looking at narrative is how we can make sense of the edge case world that we live in today. And I think it's more useful than looking at the economic machine. It includes everything that the economic machine has, but it's looking at it, I think, in a more comprehensive way with rules and laws that pertain in these circumstances that might not in, let's call it, more ordinary times.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the show today is Dave Keller. He's Chief Market Strategist at StockCharts.com, also the president of Sierra Alpha Research. And Dave, last week you sent out a warning that we could be looking at a pullback in the markets this week and pointed to a number of areas that were giving you some concern. The S&P 500 did hit a new record high around the 4360 level this week before pulling back today. We're speaking on Thursday, July 8th. The headline right now on MarketWatch is Dow drops 300 points as growth scare triggers fall in bond yields.
When I'm looking at the market conditions overall, the note that you mentioned I sent out at the end of the last week for my subscribers was really addressing the weakness sort of under the hood of the S&P and the NASDAQ. If you look at the high level indexes, you can see they've been pushing higher, consistent pattern of higher highs and higher lows. And every month in 2021, the S&P has been able to sort of push higher and make a new high for the year. But what's happened, though, in the last couple months is you're starting to see some concerning patterns, particularly in the area of breadth. And what market breadth does is it basically says the market itself is doing one thing. What are the stocks that comprise the market, right? What are the members of the indexes actually doing? Because a lot of times at the end of a bull market phase, you'll have the price continue higher as investors kind of get into a relatively narrow group of mega cap stocks as more of a defensive play, more of a late stage play. And then a lot of the individual names start to roll over. And with a lot of the breadth measures that we follow, things like the cumulative advanced decline lines, which track, you know, a daily breadth reading and smooth those out over time. You know, looking at how many stocks are above or below their 50-day moving averages, only about 50% of the S&P members right now are above their own 50-day moving average. And those signs where you have weakening breadth as the market goes to new highs is fairly consistent with previous market tops. And in fact, the last time we've seen this particular configuration is February of 2020, after the January, February higher prices, but breadth reading starting to roll over. So while I don't think that necessarily means we have another February to March 2020 in store, it certainly tells us that the bull market phase has become extended. We're in the seasonally weakest part of the year when a lot of the growth stocks have become overbought, overextended. So a pullback or a corrective pattern here would be very consistent with historical bull markets and also with the seasonal patterns of the year.
And as we often say on our show, tops are a process. They're not an event. It could be that the 4360 level was the top, or we could see another push to new all-time highs. But what you would want to see, if I gather what you said correctly, is to see if whether or not these breadth divergences persist. When we look at the S&P 500, for example, prices hitting new all-time highs as small and mid-caps continue to move lower. So if those divergences persist, that's going to continue to underscore the idea that we're in the process of putting in some type of a top. Did I get that correct?
I think that's pretty well put. And when you think of the S&P 500, we've had a number of sort of 3 to 5 to 6% corrections. If you look so far year to date, January, sort of February to March, and again in May, we had about a 4 to 5% pullback in each of those cases. In each time, we sort of pulled back to the 50-day moving average. Once the market became overextended and we saw similar conditions to what we're seeing right now. If you would go down to the 50-day moving average now, that would be around 4215, 4220 on the S&P 500, depending on how quickly it would come down. Below there, I think the real line in the sand for me would be the June low. So we bounced off of a level around 4170 a couple times, the first week in June, then again the third week in June. As long as we remain above that level, I think the structural bull market is still in case. We start breaking those levels, then I think as an investor, you have to really think about risk management as opposed to opportunity. Think more about the risk side than the return side, and focus on particularly your holdings and whether they're able to hold support levels or not. Because, you know, breaking short-term support levels often can go lower. One of my early mentors used to say, all large losses begin as small losses. So if we can keep the losses small in a pullback, then overall you can sustain the damage okay.
Okay, so again, we're seeing some breadth divergences between the S&P 500 large caps, mid caps, and small caps. You noted that we're in the seasonally weakest part of the year around July. How long does that persist when you think about seasonal weakness? What are we looking at in a time frame perspective?
Absolutely. So, you know, in general, you can think of the year as having two halves, right? You have the seasonally strongest part of the year, which is sort of the November through April period. And then starting in May through October, it's the seasonally weaker part of the year. If you look, you know, think of how people often describe the market. You have the summer doldrums. You have the, a lot of the major market bottoms have occurred in the second and the third quarter, going into a low in September or October. And that's just based on the general pattern of the year. That tends to be what you see. You'll see strength coming out of the new year. You'll see some tapering in the middle of the year, and then usually a resumption of an uptrend into the fourth quarter. And on average, the S&P has finished the year fairly constructively. And if you think of that as sort of the base case for an average year, what we have seen is the rally, from year end last year. We've had a pretty consistent uptrend. What we've not seen is any sort of really meaningful pullback. And if you're long-term bullish, which I think many people, correctly are, the challenge is when the market just continues higher and higher and doesn't have those corrective periods, you often think of it as having pent up supply, sort of a building of momentum before some sort of, massive risk off move that would alleviate the overextended nature of the market. So given the seasonal tendencies, sort of, it's often been said, sell in May and go away. And that's really driven by this seasonal two half of the year type of thesis that May through October tends to be much weaker than the other 6 months of the year. So we're sort of in the middle of that period. And summer into early fall tends to be weaker for stocks. So given the overextended conditions, having a pullback here over the next couple months would make a lot of sense based on that traditional sort of seasonal calendar trend in the markets.
Dave, any high conviction calls that you're making on the market or specific asset classes at this point?
I mean, I think if you ask me what's the one chart that you should be looking at, I would argue it's the 10-year yield and just thinking about interest rates. You know, when we think about the market conditions so far this year, when we think about market conditions through year end into next year, I think we are all going to have to deal with the fact that interest rates have been incredibly low. They've never started to increase. And based on the language that we've gotten from the Fed, there's certainly an expectation that rates are going to be going higher over the foreseeable future as the Fed sort of lightens up on their bond buying plan that they've had in place for quite a while. And I think that the Fed is going to be trying to very tenderly and gently unwinding some of the momentum that they've added to the equity markets. And I think the problem is it has a chance to really change the configuration of things very quickly. You know, if you think about the 10-year yields in the June Fed meeting, you had the Fed meeting resolved the Powell's press conference and rates spiked up immediately when there was a hint that they had been talking about changing their policy and being a little less accommodative, a little more hawkish in their tone. And I think that's a bit of a foreshadowing of what we will see as they really start to announce a broader plan to change their structure, and then into next year when you actually have implementation of that plan. So I think the chart of the 10-year is a very key one to watch, and that tells you a lot about whether banks have any chance of outperforming, because the relative strength of the financial sector is really the 10-year yield, to be honest with you. And also just the general rotation between growth and value stocks. What we've seen in the last week is you've seen rates really come down significantly. And they had been in a range on the 10-year from around 175 on the upper end, around 145 on the lower end. That's now been broken. And we've seen rates come down 1.4, 1.3, now almost 1.2. And so I think the pullback that we've seen in rates, the rally that we've seen in bonds has been very, very significant, but also a little overheated. So I think one thing I would be looking for is to get a bit of a mean reversion. Bonds have had a really good run here recently. I'd expect a bit of a pullback there in bond prices, a little bit of a bounce in yield. But overall, I think yields could go much lower than people think. I was often told early in my career, don't confuse the bottom of the page with support. Just because something has gone down a lot doesn't mean it can't continue lower. And I could see rates going below 1.2, 1.1, even 1% on the 10-year yield before the rally in bonds is over here.
Interesting. Yeah. And on the day that you and I are speaking, we saw a pretty swift decline and bounce from the 1.25 level in the 10-year treasury. So it'll be interesting to see if whether or not that is an important level of support or if we're going to break below that to even lower lows on the 10-year yield, like you said. If that were to happen, what kind of signal do you think that that would be giving in terms of the broader outlook? Would that align, you believe, with more of this market in the process of a top?
I think so. And if you look at the chart of, the cyclical sectors, look at financials, look at energy, industrials, materials, if you stop the clock in May, if you look at mid-May, all of those sectors were actually in incredible breakout mode, right? Energy stocks breaking to new swing highs, financial stocks, JP Morgan and others sort of all rotating, making new highs in this great uptrend. And then it immediately stopped. And that was, a big part of that is sort of rates sort of coming down, and all of a sudden it's much more of a headwind to the cyclicals, much more of a tailwind to the growth stocks that have done much better in the last 4 to 6 weeks. I think rates continuing lower certainly provides more of a tailwind to the growth strategy. I think you could see continued weakness in some of the cyclical sectors and continued strength in some of the in things like technology, communication services. And if we do have a market that's more in correction mode, the question is where do you go? And I could see things generally being in two places, things like utilities and real estate. The real estate sector has actually been one of the best performers year to date. A lot of people don't think about that because REITs don't tend to be the sector you would go to when the market's in a bullish trend. But it's been, it's a higher dividend yielding sector and overall has been decent performance. And then the other group would be sort of the blue chip mega cap defensive technology names, things like Microsoft, which in previous bear market moves in previous corrective cycles, something like Microsoft has held up pretty well and has been a good place to hide. So I think lower rates sort of fit into that sort of combined thesis. And also, in terms of lower yields continue lower, and all of a sudden you need to find income. And that's where things like REITs and utilities could be a little more attractive than they've been recently.
Yeah, and in today's pullback, 9 of the 11 sectors on the S&P 500 are lower. The only exception is energy and real estate at this point. So those are seeing some buying demand, we could say. So let's talk about some specific asset classes or areas of the market here. You talked about gold in your most recent update, your weekly flight plan, I believe, if I have that correct. You talked about gold, copper, and Bitcoin. Do you mind hitting on those three areas really quickly?
Absolutely. So, the chart of commodities overall has been very constructive. I would argue we're in sort of a bullish super cycle in commodities. I think a lot of things like crude oil, metals have a chance to go much higher than they've been. They've had pretty solid runs, but there's plenty of potential further upside there. With gold in particular, though, you've seen a bit of a move lower. So out of the end of the first quarter, gold was at a fairly weak point. The GLD, the gold futures, all rallied and broke to new swing highs there April into May. From there, it's retraced a good amount. So, the GLD, which is a pretty liquid gold ETF that I follow, it's bottomed out around 164. And what's happened with the chart of gold is you have what's called a bullish momentum divergence. And what that means is basically when gold prices go lower, when the price goes lower, but the momentum actually is going higher. And what that tells you is there's less and less downward momentum during the later stages of that sell-off. We saw a very similar pattern in the bond markets, things like the TLT and the AG. Before they had the rally in recent months, you had that same sort of bullish momentum divergence indicating an end to that downtrend and a potential bounce higher. We've seen that now with gold in the last week or two, and I would expect a bit of a recovery for gold stocks. It could actually serve as sort of a safe haven again. We haven't seen it as much of a safe haven at times in previous pullbacks, but the chart is suggesting a bit of a bounce there in gold. You mentioned copper, and copper, a lot of people call Dr. Copper. It's sort of a great representation of overall strength in the economic conditions. When the economy is doing well, there's a demand for copper for a lot of reasons. If you look, though, the correlation between the equity markets and copper is actually relatively non-existent right now. It's actually it's almost a non-correlation between the two. There have been times, particularly the fourth quarter of last year and the beginning of this year, where markets are going higher, copper is strengthening, and it's indicating all is well. The market in good shape, copper, prices going up, which indicates, you know, a healthy economic trends. And overall, that's sort of a sweet spot for the bull case. What's happened now is copper prices in the last month or two have actually come off pretty well, while the S&P has gone higher. I think that might be a bit of a leading indicator indicating that, you know, we talked about sort of the potential of peak growth, that sort of that growth trade might be over. I think that might be indicating a bit of a topping pattern of sorts for equities. And then finally, the third one is Bitcoin. And when I think of charts, I think of them in accumulation and distribution phases. Overall, are you seeing patterns of accumulation, the market, you know, investors buying on the dips and pushing prices higher? Or is it a period of distribution where you see more selling pressure? And I think with most cryptocurrencies, and Bitcoin is a great example, it's really more in distribution mode. You see a consistent pattern of lower highs and lower lows as the market isn't really able to sustain support levels. And this contrasts very much to, you know, the end of last year when you saw Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies in pretty consistent uptrends moving higher. The end of the first quarter, that changed. And I think for now, Bitcoin's holding with support around 30,000, which has been support in January, then again in May and in June. That's the real line in the sand I would be watching on Bitcoin. If that level breaks, which I think it's likely to do, I would expect further downside with Bitcoin, could be into the low 20s as the next downside objective there.
So, David, as we close, thank you for giving some insights into each of those areas. Again, when it comes to the broader outlook for U.S. stock market, it sounds like we could be in the process of putting in a near-term top and pull back from current levels. Of course, you want to be looking at some of these divergences. Keep in mind that we're in the seasonally weakest part of the year. But as far as, you know, the chart we all want to keep our eyes on is the 10-year. And you believe there's a chance we could be going lower on the 10-year, which would align with more of a stock market facing further trouble in terms of the growth outlook, if I got that correct.
I think that's well summarized. And then the last thing I would just say is, yeah, overall, I think, you know, over the long term, when you think about the trends in infrastructure spending and elsewhere, I think there's certainly plenty of potential upside for the long term for equities. It's all about just where we're at in the cycle. And again, given the seasonal trends and also just the run that equities have had, certainly overdue for some sort of corrective pattern. Even if long term, if you're bullish, this could be the most welcome signal to have a bit of a pullback and give investors an opportunity to buy in at a little more of a weaker level in the short term.
Yeah, because I think you and I would agree, the Fed is still a tailwind. And even though they're talking about tapering, they haven't tapered yet. And they're not moving to a tight posture. It would just be a slightly loose posture. So in terms of the overall cycle, our view is that, you know, we're still within the midst of a primary bullish trend. And it's not until we start to see some tightening with interest rate increases by the Fed that we really need to be much more worried with, along with a commensurate decline in leading economic indicators. Both of those we do not see yet at this juncture.
I think that's absolutely right. And it's funny, I would say there's a very quick reaction to any signal that the Fed is going to change anything at all. But you're right, even with some changes now or even hints of changes overall, it's still very accommodative. There's still plenty of upside to be had by their actions to continue to support the markets. I think it's going to be a difference between the short-term reaction of a change in policy versus the long-term support that they'll still be able to provide. And I think you summarized that very, very well.
All right, Dave. Well, would you mind telling our listeners how they can follow more of your excellent work at stockcharts.com or Sierra Alpha Research?
Yeah, I appreciate it so much. It's always a pleasure to join you guys. I congrats on the show, which is really, really well done. I think you guys do a fantastic job tracking the markets and helping put things into proper context. For what I do, stockcharts.com is where we focus on helping investors visualize the financial markets. My show runs every weekday after the close. It's called The Final Bar, and StockCharts TV can be accessed right through that StockCharts page. And then the other thing, if you're interested in my own work, Market Misbehavior is my website, marketmisbehavior.com, and also on YouTube. Check out my channel there. I share a lot of ideas and in-depth discussions about some of the themes we've been talking about here today.
Well, Dave, it was a pleasure having you on our show again. Thank you for the positive feedback, and we definitely look forward to having you on again. FS Insider spoke with Lisa Chai, Senior Research Analyst at Robo Global, about her most recent report, Rethinking the Logistics Roadmap, Using Technology to Transform the Supply Chain. Lisa says we are seeing swelling demand and increasing reliance on automation, robotics, and AI
when it comes to many trends that we see today. Here's a clip of what she told listeners this week.
So McKinsey said that 10 years of e-commerce adoption was compressed into 3 months during 2020. And that's all driven from the global pandemic. So obviously we're seeing this major acceleration in e-commerce sales driven by the stay-at-home culture that we had last year. But at the same time, e-commerce was the fastest growing segment of the retail industry for the last 10 years, even before the pandemic. Pandemic just accelerated all of this, right? So this is a structural shift that's happening, and it's only moving faster. And I think retailers have no option but to incorporate automation, artificial intelligence, and other supply chain solutions in order to survive.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Is your portfolio prepared for higher inflation? Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the show today is Frank Holmes. He's the CEO and Chief Investment Officer of U.S. Global Investors. And Frank, two primary areas I'd like to get in with you today are commodities, and let's include precious metals into that as well, along with Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency space, both areas I know that you are deeply involved with and have lots of interesting thoughts on. So let's start with commodities. What's your outlook on the sector currently, and what are you telling investors right now?
Well, I think that one of the best investments is going to be cargo, airlines, and shipping. The logistics of moving commodities around the world, the pricing power of ships has gone up dramatically, and the same thing with cargo airlines. I've seen the cost because we're sending, buying so much crypto mining equipment for our facilities in northern Sweden, that cost is up 500%. And so that's also related to commodities. So what's driving that is that there are supply shortages around the world for commodities. We had peak oil, Chris. We had peak oil until the frackers of Texas came along. And those frackers in the, both the Dakotas, in particular in Texas, it was a game changer. And so now we take a look at gold. There's peak gold. Gold is peaked in a supply. Copper, it's peaked. And the grades that they have to go mine for copper is declining. Chavez's long-term vision of creating turmoil all through Latin America, even though he's passed away, in Venezuela is a disaster. But he started planting seeds for socialism. Well, socialism is hitting countries like Chile and union problems. So you add the layer of union problems on top of a lower grade of copper, and guess what? You have strikes, and then you have huge supply shortages. Now we have what happened in the UN a couple of years back, where they said a high sulfur content oil, like from Venezuela, cannot go into certain tankers, and they can't go into ports. Many countries approve that, and all of a sudden, you don't have enough ships to move commodities around the world. So you have this really interesting imbalance of not only supply side coming right from the mines, you then have supply side of actually shipping them. So this is very inflationary for commodities. And that layer last year was COVID. That was another big disruptive on top of those two factors that were there prior to COVID. So as we come out of COVID, we're not totally out of it in Europe or Asia or Latin America, but we are coming out of it. You're going to see commodity prices most likely trade much higher. The last bit of icing on the cake is the green infrastructure spending passed in the EU and now being pushed here in the US. They're going to need a lot of commodities like copper.
So as you said, it sounds like you're still bullish on the overall commodity sector. We did see a very massive movement in a short period of time, higher than what I think many people had anticipated. We saw some cooling off. Overall, you think that the trend is still higher, though, for the commodity sector?
Absolutely. You're just going to limit this volatility and respect the DNA of volatility, I always tell investors, such as the stock market's DNA of volatility is less than gold. Gold is 1%. That means 70% of the time, it's a non-event for gold to go up or down 1% in a day. The stock market's 2%. Gold stocks are 3%. Crypto is 6%. Tesla is 6%. So you have to recognize what is that DNA of volatility in a particular asset class and how much should I have in my overall portfolio.
Okay. And then on top of that, you're looking at cargo, airlines, and shipping. As you said, you think that they have good pricing power in this current environment.
And you read all the reports and they have this pricing power in the next couple of years. It's not just because of COVID. You know, there's other systemic issues. And who's the most powerful, biggest company that's growth has been? Amazon. Well, what are they? They're masters of the universe of logistics. Prior to that was Walmart, masters of logistics. So logistics is going to be a very significant play in the next couple of years. And I think with $1 trillion in Europe, $1 trillion here going to infrastructure spending and build up and green infrastructure spending is huge. Solar farms, they use 20% of silver. So 20% of the demand for solar today is for solar panels. If all this money and tax credits are going to go into building solar farms, guess what? Silver trades higher. So there's a strong relationship between the green spending and certain commodities, such as silver and copper in particular.
Let's transition over to the crypto space, because I know that you've been talking about and investing around this space for quite some time now. You're not a newbie to crypto by any means. So what's going on in the crypto space? Where are we at currently?
Well, high blockchain technology, we realized 5 years ago and 4 years ago, we could not launch an ETF in the space. We had Jets ETF, and then we tried to launch our own Bitcoin ETF, but it wasn't going to happen due to anti-money laundering concerns. So we were a basically investors and in starting high blockchain technology, first big institutional check, and it took off. It was a big win. Then we had the crypto winter of 2018. 19 was the bottom. And at that bottom was marked by JP Morgan, who was always negative on crypto, becoming positive because they launched their own stable coin. So a lot of times when you see governments going after crypto or you're seeing companies, it's because they're so busy trying to get caught up. And there's a big run to update themselves with blockchain technology. We're early in this game. So last year, after the halving took place for Bitcoin in May of 2020, it took a while. Then all of a sudden that supply, the fact that the daily supply had shrunk by 50%, it started to take off in the fall. And as it took off, we saw Bitcoin and Ethereum take off, but the better performer was Ethereum over Bitcoin. And why is that? Because Ethereum is the backbone to the blockchain app world. And what we've seen now are DeFi, decentralized finance companies, exploding. They always end up using Ethereum as the basic, as more products they create, the more they use, they need Ethereum. And then the most recent has been NFTs, non-fungible transactions and coins, et cetera. These NFTs, well, baseball cards, can be music, et cetera. They become very valuable by digitizing pieces of art. Well, they always, that algorithm underneath it is, guess what? It's Ethereum. So in the past 12 months, Ethereum's doubled the performance of Bitcoin. And so I remain very bullish, and Hive is the only company that's mining both Ethereum and Bitcoin in HODLing. We're thrilled that last week we got listed on the NASDAQ. We've been up to, I think, the end of March. We follow our financials. We were, the most profitable company. I know of last year in 2020, we were up over 2,000%. But a big part of that is that we're the most profitable crypto mining company because we mine both Ethereum and Bitcoin.
Now, our podcast listeners can't see this on the screen right now, but I'm looking. It looks like you have an Ethereum shirt on right now.
I do.
Well, there you go.
Well, most of these young, brilliant minds, you know, they're young, and they could be my children. So I have to stay young by being around young minds and find out where they're going. But it's really remarkable, the ecosystem. And I try to tell gold bugs, there's not 10,000 nodes of gold analysts around the world, but there's 10,000 Bitcoin nodes around the world. When it comes to Ethereum, you're talking about 30,000. It's a big number. The ecosystem is so robust with scientists and coders and economists, et cetera. So I think that something very big is happening. I was recently at the Miami conference, spoke on a panel with other CEOs of crypto mining. This facility where they held this conference was a 15-minute Uber drive from the hotels. And still, they had 12,000 people show up and pay $600 a ticket.
Wow.
And at the gate, it was $1,200. So there's a big enthusiasm all around the world. And crypto had already come off from its peaks during this conference. It didn't matter. People believe that this should be a part of your portfolio. So I've always advocated that gold be 10%, the golden rules, the 10% rebalances once a year, and 2% alternative asset classes. And alternative asset classes in particular, Bitcoin, Ethereum. And what we found is that Hive itself traded last year 2.4 billion shares. So a lot of people have used Hive as a proxy rather than going and opening an exchange at Coinbase to go buy Bitcoin, Ethereum. They buy Hive.
So if we were to summarize some of the things that we discussed today, Frank, it sounds like, you know, you still believe investing in commodities is a good place to be long term. Of course, we see a lot of volatility in the commodity sector, just as we see a lot of volatility in the crypto space with Bitcoin and Ethereum. But you still believe that these are areas that people need to be positioned responsibly. So diversifying and not putting all your eggs in one basket. So any other lasting thoughts for our audience before we close today's interview?
And when it comes to gold, we launched an ETF a couple of years ago called Go Gold, Go AU. It's listed on the New York Stock Exchange. It's over $100 million. It's quant-driven, like our JETS. And it's outperformed the GDXJ. So I think that's another excellent product, inexpensively done with our quant approach to picking those basket of gold stocks. And it's dominated by the royalty companies. So in that weighting of 10%, 5% into a vehicle like that and 5% into bullion. You can buy beautiful 24 karat gold jewelry at Menai, M-E-N-E. And it's not a big markup and you get to wear your money just like they do in India.
You know, Frank, one last question I got to ask you is about your most recent article on Frank Talk, and it's at usfunds.com in your Frank Talk section, where you write how Bitcoin mining uses a higher mix of sustainable energy than any major country or industry. Can you tell us about this? Because I think this is a bit counterintuitive to most.
Well, what's happened is that the greenies and there's a currency out there called Ripple. Ripple's under attack by the SEC, but Ripple is not crypto mining. And they had done everything. They have bots out there in cyberspace and attacking and using information and disinformation and misinformation that crypto mining is 2% of the world's energy. I mean, it was just greatly exaggerated. But where there's some truth to all this whole argument was the biggest producer of Bitcoin was out of China. And their biggest source of energy was coal. But that's all been shut down. And that's been a big, big tectonic plate shift where crypto mining has basically become the North America and the Scandinavian countries. And I think that this is very positive and constructive for it. And the other countries called Kazakhstan, where they use a lot of coal to mine. But most of the North American mining is alternative energy. And I don't think it's this bad coal that was putting a point out there. And it's only basis points consumption of energy. And we know that the new S19s for Bitmain or M30s as ASIC chips, they're five times more fuel efficient, we call them. They give you five times the productivity for the same cost of energy. So the same thing we're seeing with Ethereum mining with NVIDIA chips. They're much more efficient and the AMD chips, but you're getting much less consumption of electricity. But I come back that the big part is the Elon Musk was concerned. He brought the attention that the Bitcoin mining community was formed. Like Bitcoin is decentralized, but we created a little charter and we did data research and we went out to did industry knowledge and studies for this council. And it basically showed that the consumption of energy is very low and it's a lot cheaper than the financial district, with how much energy they consume, all the major banks.
Frank Holmes, CEO and Chief Investment Officer of U.S. Global Investors. Frank, always a pleasure to speak with you on our show. How can our listeners follow more of your work?
USfunds.com, Frank Talk, but just go to usfunds.com and sign up for Frank Talk and our ETF. We write every week. We publish with the investment team research that goes out to about 100,000 people in 80 countries. So please join us. It's free. It's our opinions, our thoughts, and we always apply the SWOT model, that is, what were the strengths and weaknesses that impacted an asset class last week, And what economic data point coming out this week could be an opportunity threat to that asset class? And that's how we try to create, I guess, our recipe for information research.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's Smart Macro Edition. Joining us, as always, is Chris Poplava, Chief Investment Officer of Financial Sense Wealth Management. Chris, let's talk about your most recent weekly investment meeting video that we posted on Financial Sense, where you started off talking about the key distinction that we all need to understand when it comes to an expected slowing in the pace of economic growth, peak momentum, as you called it, but not a peak in the overall level of growth for this economic cycle.
You know, when you look at the business cycle, you really want to look at kind of four different quadrants or phases. And those are basically looking at the growth rate, whether it's accelerating or decelerating, and also the level, whether it's positive or negative. So in the early part of the cycle, you're starting from most likely a negative year-over-year growth rate. And then you start to move from a less negative growth rate, and you're improving but still negative. That's the early phase, and typically the riskiest assets tend to do well. That's usually a sign of a market bottom. And then you continue to accelerate at a faster appreciation or pace of economic growth, and then you move into positive territory, and you come out of a recession. Now, expansions can be long. We've had expansions, you know, run more than 9 years, and during expansions, there are times where growth is positive, but it can be slowing. So going from a 5% growth rate down to a 4, down to a 3, down to a 1, but still positive. And we had several of those over the last decade. We had a slowdown from late 2010 into 2012. We had another slowdown from roughly 2014 through 2016. And we had a third slowdown from 2018 through 2020. So the reason why this is important is usually bear markets are associated with negative growth. So this is where your growth rate is negative and falling. This is a period where you essentially want to be in cash and you want to be in long-term treasuries when rates are falling. However, when growth is falling, or I'm sorry, when growth is slowing but still positive, that usually is not a reason to go to cash. That just means that investment gains are likely to slow. This is a period in which growth may outperform value or defenses may outperform cyclicals. So it's really important to understand not just the rate of growth and where it's heading in terms of the trend, but also the level. Is it positive or negative?
You and I both have children, so we can definitely understand how our children can go through these growth spurts and grow very quickly in a short period of time. And then they may cool off for a little bit, you know, take a pause. It doesn't mean that they're done growing overall. It just means that, you know, we go through growth spurts. The economy sees the exact same thing. And you noted that looking at, if we look at manufacturing indices, you know, that there's these cyclical upturns and downturns that take place within the overall economic cycle in between recessions and expansions. So it doesn't mean that if we see a slowing in the pace of growth that, again, like you noted, that a recession is coming. It just means we're seeing a bit of a slowdown, which is necessary. You have to see a cooling off. Otherwise, inflation really does get out of hand if you're just growing at, you know, 6-7% GDP growth for, you know, quarter over quarter.
You know, I think a good analogy to that, Chris, is the stock market. You don't ever want to see the stock market go straight up. That's a bubble, and those never end well. You want to see stair steps. 2 steps forward, 1 step back, 2 steps forward, 1 step back, because that helps to alleviate excessive sentiment, bullish sentiment, speculation, overheating in the markets. Because again, as I mentioned, if you don't have any kind of relief valve for the speculation and sentiment, then you get a bubble. And that, I think that's very true for the economy, as you were mentioning, that you want to see the economy cool off for a bit and kind of get its bearings again. Because if it just goes straight up and you have this really high growth rate, well, then you're going to likely have periods of high inflation, constraints in capacity and manufacturing. And it could be with really high growth rates like that, more than likely the Fed's going to respond, hike interest rates, and then kill the recovery. So you don't want to, kind of like a long-distance runner, you don't want to be sprinting right out of the gate. You want to pace yourself. And so that's why it's good to see these slowdowns periodically, just like it's good to see pullbacks in the market.
So is that what we should expect then for inflation? Because obviously, you know, we're all talking about inflation, and this is, you know, the topic du jour on the financial media channels, how the Fed is going to respond, of course, to this. Should we expect, along with the economic peak in the growth rate of the economy, see something similar with inflation, where we do see peak inflation rate in percentage terms, year-over-year terms, but not with the longer-term average?
I think that's a good analysis. So essentially, I do think, and part of this is just base effects. I mean, think about it. A year ago, we had oil in negative territory. So obviously, the year-over-year appreciation of oil is going to be off the charts. And so it does make sense that we've likely seen a near-term peak in inflation, or we're going to be seeing one, you know, roughly around now, because the inflation rates were so low last year. So I do think the year-over-year appreciation in inflation may have peaked near-term, and it might cool down. However, I think we're going to see above-average levels of inflation, because I feel we're going to see above-average levels of trend growth in the economy. One of the things I've been highlighting to our team over the last couple of weeks is that if you look at inventories, especially for retail inventories, we have record lows in terms of inventory to supply. We're seeing that in housing. We're seeing that in autos. We're seeing that all over the place. And so manufacturers essentially are running at full capacity just to meet current demand. But if you think about it, if they're doing that just to meet current demand and there's still massive backlogs, how are they going to increase inventories back to normal levels? And the only way to do that is to have a sustained period of high activity that works through current demand and then eventually catches up to be able to exceed demand so that they can replenish inventories. One of the other things I'll be really interested at looking at over the next year is where inventories start to normalize. So what we had been used to for decades is just-in-time inventory, where essentially companies had really low inventories, and we had a global supply chain. However, what COVID really showed was the vulnerabilities of that. Essentially, having most of our pharmaceuticals manufactured in China, or personal protection equipment manufactured in China. This is a problem. We cannot be dependent with our supply chain on China, especially if we have geopolitical risks associated with China. So I am curious that the manufacturing upcycle that I see in terms of meeting current demand and replenishing inventories to normal levels, I'm wondering if it'll be prolonged even further if we see inventory levels above average, as we have more onshoring and a move away from just-in-time inventories.
Yeah, and as we've discussed with you in the past, I mean, this whole transitory versus persistent inflationary outlook, it's both. It's both going to be transitory in terms of the rate of growth, as we discussed earlier, but then also persistent on a longer-term basis. And that has to do with the fact that, you know, we're looking at higher commodity prices, higher food and energy prices, higher rents, which is the largest component of the CPI. And you had discussed and showed in prior weekly investment videos that you can see the lead-lag relationship between housing prices and rental prices. Those are expected to go up because of housing prices. That's going to put upward pressure on the inflation, the official inflation figures. So these are some of the things that we're looking at for a more long-term persistent outlook for inflation, but again, also cautioning investors not to expect the very, very fast rates of inflation that we see this year to persist. So, you know, obviously there's some nuances here, and you need to understand that this isn't just a very simple binary thing. There's multiple things operating here. Along those lines, where do interest rates in the yield curve fit into this whole discussion?
Well, you know, I think this is a really good general topic. You know, as we were talking, you don't want to see straight up or down moves. You want to see stair-stepping. And one of the things that we saw once interest rates here in the U.S., long-term treasuries bottomed, and they started to meaningfully move up beginning in August of last year, it was a pretty much an uninterrupted run all the way into March and April of this year. We saw the 10-year treasury roughly move from 0.5% all the way up to about roughly 1.8% in a very linear fashion. And what we saw was a lot of people piling on their shorts on bonds. Everyone had lower maturities in their bond portfolios, and everyone thought that the 10-year was heading north of 2%. And then sure enough, we saw lumber prices start to collapse. We saw other things that are starting to hint that we could be in for a pause. And one of the things that we are seeing is that the 10-year Treasury yield dropped all the way down to roughly its 200-day moving average yesterday and put in a hammer, which means it pushed lower and then closed near the upper end of the day's range yesterday, and we have some follow-through today. So I think so far what we've had really in the second quarter was a nice consolidation of the reflationary trade. A lot of commodities rolled over during that period. Copper peaked. Lumber, as I mentioned, had peaked. Other metals peaked. And to me, I do not think that long-term rates are done rising. And part of that, as I mentioned to you, is I do think we're going to have a prolonged manufacturing cycle. And second, if we saw a peak in long-term treasuries, this would be the smallest spread in the yield curve since the mid-1980s. Typically, you see the 10-year treasury yield move above the 2-year treasury yield by roughly anywhere from 2.5% to almost 3%. And as I mentioned, we only made the spread was only roughly about 1.5% earlier this spring. So to me, that would be a very short move or steepening of the yield curve. I think we've got a lot more, particularly given the Fed says they're not likely to raise rates until 2023. So we have, you know, roughly over a year and a half to go before the short end moves up. And I think there's plenty of time for the long end to continue moving up. So for me, I think, you know, the second quarter was a good quarter in the terms of washing out and kind of removing some of the froth in terms of the bond bears out there. So that's what I'm going to be watching at really intently, is to see if I'm correct. If I am, then we should start to see the 10-year treasury yield slowly begin to move up. But for it to have peaked already this cycle, this would be a very shortened cycle, and we don't even have the Fed raising interest rates yet. So to me, I think it's unlikely that the 10-year treasury is done rising and that the yield curve is done steepening.
And if the converse were true, then we should be a little bit worried about the Fed tightening more than what the market anticipates, or that really putting a damper on the economy. Obviously, you know, they're just talking about tapering, so we're not yet at that point. But the yield curve is a way of assessing if the Fed is too tight or too loose.
You know, that's true. Essentially, what we typically see is the yield curve inverts, which means short-term rates are higher than long-term rates, and that discourages bank lending, which then begins to cool the economy. We saw the yield curve invert in early 2006 and then again in 2007, just before the 2008 recession. We also saw the yield curve invert in 2019 ahead of the 2020 recession. Now, I know the recession was the biggest cause, that was a pandemic. However, we typically almost always see the yield curve invert before a recession. So, you know, seeing the yield curve starting to flatten here, you know, is to me almost a sign of maybe a potential policy error in terms of the Fed. And this really began in earnest over the last 4 to 6 weeks. And that to me was related to the June Fed meeting, in which they indicated their preference to begin tapering their purchases sooner. And they also raised interest rates on overnight lending rates. And so that had some shifts in the market that I think the market wasn't ready or prepared for.
If you wouldn't mind, boil all this down for us when it comes to what you expect for the global markets and the economy moving forward from here.
Essentially, I think what we're headed for, Chris, is a slowdown in the growth rate, but still a positive level of growth. And in fact, not just a positive level, I think economic growth will be above trend, meaning that we'll be running hotter than normal. And that's because of all the fiscal and monetary stimulus. So for me, you know, to even think of a bull market top, I think is too premature. You know, corrections in markets are normal. Stocks are inherently volatile, as are commodities. It's not surprising to see a 10% pullback in the markets, you know, roughly every 1 to 2 years. I believe on average, the market sees 3-5% pullbacks a year is pretty typical. So stock markets, you know, they're volatile. So even in a growth slowdown, that's typically when you tend to see these corrections begin, where stocks cool off a bit. So if we are heading into a growth slowdown, which I do believe, we could see some more volatility this summer. But to me, that's not a nail in the coffin for this bull market or expansion. I think we've got a long runway ahead of us still.
Once again, Chris Poplava, Chief Investment Officer at Financial Sense Wealth Management. Chris, always a pleasure speaking with you on our show.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Look forward to talking to you in 2 weeks.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth advisory team, which has been servicing clients for over 35 years, feel free to give us a call at 888-486-3939. Also, don't forget to tell your friends and family about our podcast, Financial Sense News Hour, to stay on top of the latest developments in the market and how they impact your investments. Lastly, if you aren't already a subscriber and would like to listen to more of our premium content airing 3 days during the week through our website or through an app on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.